Don't worry, Paul, I just painted your honor.
I'm like, I'm not just going to mail away. I'll be the other thing.
Michael, that's going to be Michelle. Nicholas Osei.
That's correct.
And you're a principal scientist and director of Trebius Environmental Limited.
That's correct.
And did you provide a statement of evidence dated 28 July 2023 and a statement of rebuttal evidence dated 14 August 2023?
I did.
And were you a party to the joint witness statement that emanated from the Water Quality Conferencing on 4 and 5 September 2023.
I was.
And do you affirm that the contents of your briefs of evidence and the statements attributed to you and the joint statements are true and correct?
Yes, I do.
Are there any matters of correction or addition to your briefs of evidence?
Yeah, actually, I have a small correction to make to my witness in chief on page 42. Legend to table for some important government base that should read reductions in nitrogen from human activities, so strike out from human sources, required to meet with the quality target that should stay in the so strike out work of the river and be replaced by the 8 subcations requiring greater reductions than the whole location.
Thank you.
And again, you've also got some additional speaking notes, which check the true and correct as well. Yes, your knowledge and belief.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Just answer any questions from my friends.
What proportion of permanent and intermittent strains have femoral inflows?
I don't have a specific number to give, but most we have because it's surface water probably in your so we have what we call runoff again. One is also land. It flows into the streams that way, so most of them would. tackle some of a few sections like spring feed, spring, for example, and have at that point
start with questions about your table 2 in your evidence in chief. So you've calculated the anthropogenic flow reductions required for table phosphorus and total nitrogen in terms of the interim improvements required and the 80-year state and the improvements required to achieve the 80-year states. Now, first of all, those percentages could vary in the future and at different localities, and I want to put to you a variety of reasons that they could alter. The first is, of course, because they do not reflect at the moment ecosystem health states for these, and I'm talking about the tributaries there, I should clarify.
just to be clear, the table 2 numbers all relate to the bottom of the catchment there. Kind of subtle overall catchment reductions that are required to achieve, as you say, the short term and long term targets. As far as what the target action states relate to, then the table 3 the nitrogen numbers relate to toxicity, which is a component of ecosystem health. It's critically important to ecosystem health. So the classification of ecosystem health and non-ecosystem health is not particularly a good one. So, but take your meaning, so those relate only to toxicity. They don't relate to the control that nutrients might exert on tropic states, and especially the environment growth.
Thank you, that's what I was meaning. Again, in relation to the tributaries, you've pointed out in your evidence that states that the tributaries don't add up to what's required at the main stem.
That's correct, they were different in technology. I think I've got to some extent, I'm trying to explain that.
Yes. And you've also acknowledged in your evidence that the policy 3.13 of the NPSFM, which relates to setting nitrogen and phosphorus states, in addition to what we've just talked about in terms of toxicity and ecosystem health, has also not been applied in relation to meeting targets at nutrient-sensitive downstream environments such as lakes and wetlands.
So it has in terms of the lower reach of the river, but it has not in terms of other downstream environments such as the estuary, the water estuary, and also lakes and wetlands.
And there could be quite significant differences if we look at those 59 identified lakes. There could be quite significant differences required with nitrogen and phosphorus targets, interim targets that are set in the future with respect to those to achieve ecosystem health, and lakes couldn't there.
Absolutely. I think Mr. Clee gives some really nice examples of that by looking at nutrient reductions, catchment, low nutrient reductions, and low disease at the minimum. So, yeah, and specific lake catchments, we're looking at potentially quite different numbers in the future, but those are going to be really okay.
Yes. Thank you. But so, despite those issues, which will have to be dealt with in the 2024 plan change, for current purposes, from your perspective, the PC1 attribute states are targets for the purposes of the NPSFM?
I believe so. Well, in so far as they're consistent with the latest version, but yes.
All right. I'd like to refer to policy 11 of the NPSFM, which I'll let you turn to, and I'm going to go through the logic that I discussed yesterday in terms of how policy 11 fits in with the definitions.
That's policy 11.
Policy 11. Under 2.2, the policies.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's on page 10.
Thank you.
So policy 11 is freshwater is allocated and used sufficiently. All existing over-allocation is phased out, and future allocation over-allocation is avoided. And then we go. If we can turn to page 7, we go to the definition of over-allocation. And paragraph B there says, if limits have not been set, because my understanding is that limits have not been set yet, is that your understanding as well?
Well, some limits have been set, but not the limits in the sense of an allocation to meet the target states. So I think there's quite a lot of debate about exactly what is a limit on the piece, but from a technical point of view.
Yes, I accept that. So, if limits have not been set, an FMU or part of an FMU is degraded or degrading. And on the page before that, page 6, there's a definition of degraded and a definition of degrading. What's your view on whether we can say that that applies at the moment, based on your knowledge of the state of the catchments?
I think it's covered in the joint business statement, but I'll think I need to go back to that. But essentially, the whole of catchments at the moment, following those definitions, is what are allocated for all four things. And then when we look FMU by FMU and sub-catchment by sub-catchment, essentially, the sub-catchments where we've got target ocean states that we're equivalent to the baseline states, it means full allocation, and where the target ocean states are better, so requiring improvement into the current, or what was called current, sorry, which is called baseline. When there is an improvement required, then that's an indication, well, it's the proof, I guess, that it is allocated for the purpose for that continuous and that sub-catchment.
Thank you. So is it your view that over-allocation, as defined in the NPSFM, occurs at the moment, and there may be some further analysis that's required, particular sub-catchments, but at the catchment scale?
Oh no, I don't think we need further analysis. We know which ones are over-allocated. So they're all either fully allocated or not over-allocated. The whole of the catchment is over-allocated, especially for nitrogen and phosphorus, by the amounts that are in my table 2. And for sub-catchments, when we start looking at fine farm and grain, some will be over-allocated for nitrogen, some will be fully allocated. So it's a simple method of going through table 3 and 1. If that's the granularity that you're requiring.
All right, thank you. So at paragraph 71 of the amendment, you point out that should one type of discharge reduce their emissions by a smaller percentage required, another type of discharge would have to reduce more, and this is the concept of proportionality, isn't it?
Well, it's simple arithmetics, really. If we need to reduce the catchment rules or nitrogen by, I think in the short term, it's about 500 cc tons, that's in my table two. I suppose, if no reductions are made in part of the catchment, or by some sectors in the other places or other sectors, you have to do that in order to reach the thinking target.
Mm. And similarly, if we take the example of the allocation that's provided for commercial vegetable production, which is predicted to increase the load of nitrogen at the monitoring points at the bottom of the catchment of 0.5%, that will mean that other parties have to do more than their fair share in order to meet the reductions required.
I guess I can't comment on what is fair share, but not an equal share, that's for sure. If I understand well the numbers, I think the estimate is an additional 80 tonnes of nitrogen per year. Again, if I refer you to my table 2, so based on those calculations, so it's based on the WRC, made. In the next 10 years, we need to reduce the catchment load in terms of total margin by about 570 tons per year. So I guess if you add 80 tons to that, that's 611, which adds 15% to the load of nitrogen that will need to be reduced by in the next 10 years. So it's actually not an insignificant portion of the reduction that we will require. So it adds to the challenge, I guess. It adds 15% to the challenge.
Right. Okay, thank you. And also, technically, would you say that increasing, although it may be stated to be 0.5%, is technically over-allocation, and increasing over-allocation under policy even of the NZCN?
If nothing else was done, yes. I guess to not create or further over-allocation, you would have to compensate the increase by the further increase only. I guess again, it's simple arithmetic squared. So those 80 tons would have to be absorbed or reduced by another sector. I don't know if that's helpful to the court, but I'll look a bit at the numbers there, and based on these eastern regions, I think the existing losses from the CDP sector are about 397 tons per year. So we were going to reduce those by 7.2%, which is the contribution to the reduction requirement of all protections. That leads to about 368 tons per year, which is not really equal reductions. To fit the 80 tons into that number, the existing losses would have to be reduced by about 27%. So to fit within the whole of the same sector, that reduction. So it's the size of the reduction we have to refine the existing activities, the emissions from the existing activities to fit the extra 80 tons.
Yes, so just to ask you about the offsetting and compensation. The existing activities might have to address some of this through mitigating their existing losses of nitrogen, but if they do need to offset and compensate, what's your, can you just clarify your view, please, on the concept of nutrient trading and whether it's acceptable to offset nitrogen with E. coli, which is more water trading, but or offset nitrogen with phosphorus? Do you have a view on that?
Probably a complex view. Suppose the catchments are about occasions for all four contaminants. So I guess allowing an increasing one to decrease another one doesn't really meet the intent, I guess, or the duration of the requirement. And again, you know, reflecting on this morning's conversation, this has been looked at as a whole, and as a whole, it looks at reducing community effects, it aims at not increasing any other contaminants, and that was talking about the house and to move into the other. So it's kind of, it's not unfair, it's not all or anything, so to me, it's all four contaminants that we have to reduce. That being said, you could have a smaller decrease of one and a larger decrease of the other one, and it can be traded between users and stuff that that is complicated. But I think on the first instance principle, that's where the all four terminals are going to be used.
All right. Thank you. Do you agree with Dr. Corcoran's evidence on the concepts of offsetting and compensation, or would you?
It's not an area where I'm not a specialist in that.
Okay, alright. No, thank you. Just turning to a particular issue around lakes. In your rebuttal evidence, Dr. O'Shea, you do, at paragraph 15, recognise a significant risk for locking in emissions and EPPs in the lake catchments. And you discuss the methodologies, including providing information on the CCCV regarding low reductions needed for lakes. And you also talk about bringing action plans for lakes forward, I think. Is that right?
Yes, I guess what I was pointing to is the principle that lake management and lake restoration is about the fixed. Has to be looked at lake by lake, and some lakes might be able to apply in lake remediation and catchment remediation, for example. So it's quite detailed where it needs to happen. And if I could see a timing issue there in the sea state, we brought forward the preparation of farm plans in some of the lake catchments, but we haven't done the fundamental work that needs to be done to. There's lake management plans to know by how much we need to reduce the catchment loads, for example. So there's a risk in there that the farm plans will be prepared in the absence of that information that relates specifically to the lake. So it might be that it's entirely fine to have those farm plans developed on the general principles from now, but it would have to be on the understanding that it might need to be reviewed once we know more of that what needs to happen in that kitchen. That's purely from a technical point of view. I totally appreciate it has a lot of implications in the background, but from a technical point of view, late kitchens are going to be a bit more tricky in this condition.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Clay has set out a table which shows baseline states for 31 monitored lakes in the region, and that's, he's suggesting that be included in Table 311.1d. Now, I take it from reading your rebuttal evidence that you don't have a problem, and you would think it's a good idea to state baseline states for lakes in the plan, given that we have that information.
Where we do have the information, is that there are things that I can. At least we can look at how far off the bottom line, that's where the initial bottom line is going to be before it starts.
Thank you. And just finally, still on lakes, Fish and Game seeking a 20 metre step back from lakes based on Dr. Hewitt's evidence, which discusses something called the Birch effect, which you're no doubt familiar with, and the effect of stock in that setback when inundation occurs, which can be beyond, well beyond 3 metres, sometimes beyond 10 metres. Do you have any comment to make on Dr. Stewart's recommendation in that regard?
Yes, I guess it's, again, it's quite difficult to comment on what a minimum setback distance is. It's very specific to the case. For a lake, the setback distance first keeps the stock out, then the second thing is to avoid having the inundation and the lakes go up and down as far as natural processes and water regulation in the lake catchment. Yes, if asphalt farm land is inundated, it can bring contaminants back with it from the trees. And I guess the last thing is the fact that a lot of parts of the margins of the lake can also be requiring rituals, and those are already used as a tool in terms of denitrification, so intercepting or removing some of the nitrogen that may be coming from the catchment if they intercept groundwater. But those will occur around the whole of the lake. So, sorry, there's a long response to say, I think on a lake by lake basis, that needs to be looked at to, I think, 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 metres is particularly the right answer, but rather to strategically grab the bits of lignon particularly around the lake and avoid having too much of the inundation with going into crystal without taking unnecessary manure production as well. So I think probably 10 meter setback as a general rule is not a bad guideline, but being the ability to extend it when the farm plan actually occurs to capture marginal electrons and the critical source of noise potentially would be an initial flexibility to have in there.
All right, thank you. And just to follow up to that, are you aware that many of these named lakes in the Waikato region already have significant riparian planting around and setbacks already?
Some of them do, yes. Pretty obvious from the plan.
Pardon?
It's pretty obvious from the plan.
Yes. All right. Very good. Thank you, Dr. Arthur.
Thank you.
Mr. Majuri, I apologise. I think I overlooked calling on you for the previous witness. Any questions for this witness? No, thank you. Any re-examination?
No.
Any questions for Chris? No. Christian Hodges, thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. Jose. I'm sure you expect the old question from me.
Very well.
I was.
Who says that?
You can see what a trial I have to go through.
Order.
At 106 of your evidence, and Jim, you don't need to go there, but you consider that some of the model predictions relating to E. coli and sediment to be surprisingly optimistic.
Yes.
Can you please explain the reasons for reaching that conclusion and what you think might be more realistic conclusions as best you can?
I guess there's a few reasons that I know historically that the modeling was done was primarily focused on nutrients. Probably E. coli and the sediment got less attention. The second thing is the effectiveness of management actions on farms on E. coli and on sediment are very hard to model to the point that for E. coli we don't really know. We know that some actions will reduce the E. coli inputs in terms of quantifying it as an effectiveness at a whole of farm scale. We don't actually have generalized numbers. And likewise for sediment, the assumptions that were taken in the model, I think, for the implementation of a simple farm plan was a flat 70% reduction in sediment inputs from the farm to the waterway. In 10 years, and then results as they are, would suggest that we see straight away the improvement in the river within that same 10-year period. Now, if you just look at the temporal evidence of it, a lot of erosion control measures when involved planting the trees, it'll take 5, 7, 10 years to start being effective at retaining soil. Then the sediment, the natural processes of sediment and the catchment is that it will take years and years to actually grow from the top to the bottom. So all that, the model was showing 500% improvement in visual clarity within the first 10 years of that site. This is just not going to happen. That's not seen in any catchment. That doesn't mean that the work that's been proposed as part of the farm plan is not the right one, but I think it's somewhat misleading when you just look at the results. That all these targets are going to be met within the first 10 years seems radically optimistic. I'm happy to be probably wrong in 10 years.
No, I think you just hit the nail on the head that I've been concerned about throughout this hearing, but there are, the expectations are overly optimistic in quite a significant way. That's where I've been coming from, and that seems to be your view.
Yes, and I guess, this is just a model. It's useful to give us a direction of travel and what we might expect at some point in the future. But it puts if you want to focus on good monitoring, it's you put in place where you can actually measure what's happening rather than rely on modeling that's good.
Well, that's helpful, thank you. And you've talked about the need to remove fine particles to get the best improvement in water clarity, is that correct?
Yes, I agree, but I can't remember saying that in particular.
I think it's a paragraph 83. In most riverside catchments of the Peacock One area, water clarity will directly be associated with the presence of fine suspended sediment in the water column.
Oh, yes. So that was in specifically in relation to the fact that in the main stem of the lower Waikato, the visual clarity is affected by the sediment, the fine sediment in suspension, but also the plinthally gating that is also in suspension. And so when we are setting targets for visual clarity in the lower Waikato and in the lakes, we need to look at both the sediment component but also the nutrient component because they drive the plinthally gating that goes. Whereas in the most running streams, there's not enough time for it's not the right media for plinthally gating to grow. So the visual clarity is just associated with the sediment.
Okay, so really the issue is not so much the need to get all the fine sediment out in your stretch of your 10 meter strip, for example. It's also related fairly heavily to the planktonic growth. Is that
for the lower Waikato, yeah. I was trying to draw the distinction between the drivers of poor visual clarity and the main stem of the lower river, as opposed to the tributaries. So the tributaries were just looking at sediment, which is problematic.
No, I understand, thank you. One of the difficulties that I think everyone faces is there's no way of actually a farmer knowing that I've done this will make this much difference to the river. Do you know if anybody's done any work along those lines anyway?
It's actually been my life over 2.5 years to try and develop better monitoring programs essentially to better assess the effectiveness at catching scale of mitigation issues. But in short, no, we haven't been doing a really good job of that, of being able to demonstrate causality, a bunch of actions on a bunch of farms and improvement in water. There's some smaller scale initial basis for it, but surprisingly at larger sort of catching scale, it's really not pretty wide. And that's, I guess, that's really, again, going back to having really good monitoring programs, it's really important that we are able to demonstrate to that we are making progress. So otherwise, why wouldn't we make an effort? So of course, all this work, there's a lot of hard work and investment that's going in. We're not validating it particularly well, but good work to prove it after.
So if you really seem to be talking about having sample areas where you do intensive monitoring in some areas, would that be right for you?
That's right, as part of my additional speaking points that we tend to rely on sort of set of environment monitoring regimes that are based on monthly sampling, and they give us some really good information on the real backbone of the system. But when we ask them to be a pointy question of the monitoring system, and especially this one about effectiveness and people change, having higher density of data on monitoring strategies can really help having an insight faster. And going back to the fresh work, the whole fresh work of legislation being there to make a measurable improvement in 5 years, monthly data that's been detecting change over 10 years and over. So higher frequency monitoring of targeted monitoring during higher flow events to be able to characterize the load as part of the monitoring strategies that have been employed in.
Okay, thank you. And one last question. There is a lot to be done, and it's not going to be possible to do everything straight away. Almost an impossible question to answer, but do you have a preference for where the initial focus should be in terms of, say, fencing streams, or what, where would you say, based on your experience, the best bang for the buck would come from?
In terms of location or type of?
In terms of benefit to the receiving environment, to the ROI.
That's a big question. Well, I guess that I think going back to the fact that a whole lot of catchment is well located, it's really making sure that there is a general realization that people are running to the unit. We can focus efforts on a lot of resources and a small part of the catchment, but that will not make it. The effort will be diluted in the downstream, so I think it's more a blanket effort across the whole catchment that will meet particular climate action as opposed to, it's more the whole gambit of farm plans and stock exclusion that is required, I think. I don't know if that answers your questions correctly.
No, it does. As I said, it's really good one to answer. Sorry, there is one other thing. You mentioned the fact that one of the other areas I've been interested in is not just focusing on PC1 on its own, but the recognition that there's a lot more to be done afterwards. And how do we ensure that what's done in PC1 is going to be valuable in subsequent stages? And one example of that is if a farmer put in a lot of money into fencing and then found in 10 years' time that actually land has to be retired. So there's a need to think ahead, I believe, in terms of planning PC1 to try and make sure that what's done there is not going to be lost at some later stage. Do you have a comment on that?
I have a few, but I guess one of the reasons I insisted so much in my business and of course around actually really communicating the size of the effort, the reductions that need to be made, both at the catchment and sub-catchment scale, as to this is really important information to communicate to the farming community at large. This is the size of the overall reduction that is required. So this is signals that what needs to be made now, and I think that's the intent of PC1, but there will be more coming later. And so on a business by business basis, you can plan around that, but I'm not saying it's easy. I think communicating clearly that information on tables 3 and 4 around what overall we're going to have to reduce phosphorus by the phosphorus that we're going to lower. 3%. There's a bit of a sobering fine when we look at 25% reduction overall, but because we only able to act on half of it, we need to reduce that half by 50%. I think that's one way to avoid surprises. Then from a straight planning point of view, we can make a lot of effort to make sure that it's consistent with. It's quite hard because PC1 has got three key system versions of Go, I guess. But to bring it back in line with this one, with the latest one, so usually some of those attributes can directly be uplifted into the next version of it, for sure. And it would, the borders having to redo things, I suppose.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for your evidence, Dr. Rosa. Your excuse.
Thank you.
If I could call Mr. Brock.
Thank you.
So you can only consider the privilege of hearing the terms of their personal rights to the sport shall be received from the nature of the matter on the trip.
Right, so can you confirm that your full name is Graham Ritchie Brough?
It is.
And you are a director of Brough Resources Management Limited?
I am.
And in this proceeding you have provided a statement of evidence dated 28 July and a statement of rebuttal evidence dated 11 August, and you also participated in two joint witness conferencing sessions that of point source discharge on the 18th of September and that of planning from the 11th to the 14th of September. And do you confirm that the context of your two briefs of evidence and the statements attributed to you, the positions attributed to you, the two joint witness statements are truly correct to the best of your knowledge and belief? And do you have any corrections or additions to your two briefs of evidence as filed?
Not really, just to say that the documents were handed around supersede past members and chief if they relate to that particular section.
Thank you. And in that regard, just to confirm, I provided earlier today a version of Schedule C and then policies 5.18 and a new rule 3.11.4.7b, and you have reflected further in your evolutionary progression and made a couple of additional tweaks, and there is now an updated version of that that's been provided over lunch, which has been circulated to council and to the court. That's correct?
That is correct.
So these are the two documents which don't have a heading, but one of them is a fact change version of policies 5 and 18, rules 3.11.4.4, 3.11.4.7d, and the new rule 3.11.4.9, and the amended Schedule C.
I believe so, sir. Probably the best way to work out the difference in versions is Schedule C has fact changes on it.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Yes, and so these are the same documents, albeit that Mr. Brough didn't have the versions of the headers on overnight, so they replaced those two.
So I'll just note these as Mr. Brough for the 9th of November 23.
So the most up to date is one that arrived at lunch, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
With no attribution on it. Now, I was going to invite the Book of the Nature of Business Book just to perhaps provide an explanation, but I'm happy equally, Sarah, if you think it's more constructive, for people just to ask questions if they wish. Mr. Brown had a couple of comments that he thought might be helpful to make.
I don't think these documents are at all mysterious, but yes, Mr. Brown, if you want to just introduce them, that would be helpful.
Certainly. So if we turn to the GDC document first. So my thinking around this, having heard much of the evidence from farmers and growers in other experts, and I suppose pondering on GDC as a position in various regions of it, I thought it might be useful to the court if I tried to unclutter some parts of that particular schedule. And the main driver for me was the cross-referencing through to the stock exclusion and farm land regulations that had almost overtaken the document itself, and I thought there may well be a future risk that if those regulations were changed, then sheep and seed rights regulations also changes, and if those regulations are diluted, then potentially we lose some of the ground that I won't say we agree, but we might have landed on. So those are the main points of focus. And I guess the changes that I've made since the first version of the item is more of an epiphany, I guess, around the term more practicable, and trying to, in discussions with Mr. Lovelace, trying to provide some more common sense and logic to it, and get some of the flow that might be required if a planner was not deluded in the farm system, yes, it was.
Thank you.
I think I can promise that you can see if I can move through the other documents here if you would like.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, so this is in relation to the pathway for the transfer care on central land. And what might be we've changed the narrow pathway compared, I think, different experts answer questions. Mostly of a common nature, I think, in respect of capacity headroom, which has always perplexed me in terms of how you determine whether or not there is capacity headroom in a subcatchment where some of the federal and central land, or in fact any land that might be subject to land use change, would be land use change in itself. So to add some clarity around policy 18, I thought it would be useful to provide direction to consent planner. The potential you can look at the cumulative implementation of Chapter 3.11. That might provide some guidance as to whether or not the implementation of all those matters, and I've been doing this in PC1, may have led to a trajectory of change downward, and therefore there may be an ability to look at whether it's scheduling and capacity to accommodate tons of current central lands. With the proviso, of course, that you don't lose ground on the trajectory. So that's the basis of my new 18B.
I know that you haven't received recognised an account for.
No.
Do you think that goes too far?
If we had an operational accounting framework that was able to provide us with some more clarity, I think it would be appropriate. And I'm not familiar with the term account for in a planning sense, so that's probably the reason why I wouldn't go there.
Okay.
This is just my amendment to rule through the 470. I've just been able to update that particular law for maintenance and chief. Given that I've heard much of the evidence, again, more around the doing bits of plan change one and trying to tie in some of the language around action plans and the farm plan regulations, and ensuring that mitigations were put in place had time frames around them and they were being subject to the consent process.
And then just carving that out from 311.49.
Sorry, that's correct. do believe that 3-1 has a place, but of course it would need a proviso to ensure that the proper landing place for Tungsten Federal Ancestral Land would be much superior to the rule.
Mr. Brough, and thank you for your continued work on revisions. We will be considering those further, and I don't plan to take you through questions on those in particular, but I appreciate the work you put in. Can I take you to your evidence in chief, paragraph 31? Now you say there, you talk about what the hearing panel was saying in terms of ancestral land, and you have noted there it's of fundamental importance for any application for the development of Tangatino ancestral land, irrespective of the activity status of the rule, that it must be consistent with putting the Waikato and Waipa catchments on a track towards restoration and protection of their health and well-being. Now that remains your view regardless of activity status?
It does.
And the legal submissions for the Riverie, we make it clear at paragraph 45 that Te Ture Whai Mana requires a strong focus on restoration and protection of the water quality of the awa. That's something you'd agree with as well?
I do.
Would you accept that in light of that focus, any provisions that provide a route for land use intensification in these catchments need to be expressed very carefully?
Yes.
Now, turning to paragraph 146. Yes, sorry, same document. We talked there about the new rule 3.11.4.9, the land use change rule, the non-compliant to be one. You say there at the end of that paragraph, it's clear to me the Riverie, we were also cognizant that that rule performed the dual role of halting the wide scale and unmanaged land use change that had previously occurred in the catchment, and secondly being the narrow rule gateway for any application to development TWAR. Then in 147 you go on to use a phrase you used before, which is that it's a narrow window. Do you agree that the reason for that narrow window is because it is difficult to both provide for land use change and at the same time restore and protect the awa?
It is difficult. I would say it's a wicked problem. I guess through the context of 146, that particular view was used when the plan was notified. So the only pathway available for any land use change at that time was the signature of the policy was under the federal ancestral land. That is now not the case. So I think within that context is where I agree with that particular statement. But to your question directly, it is difficult, but it's not impossible. I think Dr. Say said quite clearly that there is a lack of an accounting framework and there is no empirical data or information that could be used at this point in time I'm aware of that I think facilitates the wrong thing, but at least assist the consideration and application. So yes, it is essentially at this point in time difficult.
Yes. And in the absence of a Glenn Maxwell type miracle solution, we need a window, but we need it to be narrow.
I think that's a useful analogy, except to say that Glenn Maxwell did not score all of the runs. And I think you have the ability to create an accounting system which is robust and can do the job, so I don't think we need to wait for magic solutions, if that's what your question is about.
In the period between now and when that allocation accounting framework might be available, I suppose the point I think we're in agreement on is that it's both very important to both provide for land use change and protect the awa, which means that it is important that there is a window, but it's also important that the window is narrow and carefully framed. Is that fair?
I agree with that.
Do you consider it will be possible, in light of Objective 4 and Policy 18, to obtain a resource consent for land use change on Tangatapu ancestral land as a non-compliant activity?
Yes, it would be possible.
Thank you, Mr. Brough. Thank you, Ron.
Good afternoon, Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon,
Mr. Brown. For the Legal Counsel, Director General of Conservation. So, I just have a couple of clarifying questions. And you've just explained that Policy 18 is kind of a carve out and a pathway for China to be remained, ancestral land.
I wouldn't describe it as a carve out, I would describe it as policy support for China to be.
So, in terms of, are you aware of the offsetting and compensation good practice guidance?
I'm familiar with it, but not entirely.
So, is that guidance incorporated in Policy 18 at all?
Not explicitly. No, it's not referenced.
Do you agree that that would be useful to do that?
Are you meaning replacement of the policy file or in addition to it?
I guess to support in terms of the understanding the principles of offsetting and compensation.
I think in the current guidance, my view is Policy 5 is just not available to the time of ancestral land development. And I say that because it's done on a problem by problem basis. And I'm happy to prove wrong, but I really can't see it being used when you have a property or a land block or a set of land blocks that are undeveloped. And then you have to try and apply some offsetting regime over them that can internalize the level of discharge that you create from individual energies, so I don't think that's available. In terms of compensation, if you use the widest means of compensation, perhaps, but I think we run into the same problems very quickly, that you don't really know the subject and where the land might be located, what that compensation might look like. So I'm going to say no.
So, I'll just rephrase, but I think where I'd headed is in terms of the guidance around what those terms mean. Have you seen the evidence of Dr. Corbury?
I have, it was a while ago.
Okay. In your evidence, she talked about the principles of offsetting and principles of compensation, and those good practice principles can help with the interpretation of what those terms mean.
Well, that might be, or might be a utility in terms of assisting policy profit.
Thank you. So I've just got a moving now to Schedule C. I just have a question regarding Clause 6C. So that 6C, 3 metres, that applies across all land. If you want to have this to know our ancestral land, that's your intent.
Where it's relevant and informed by clauses 1 and 2, is correct?
Correct.
Right.
evidence that Mr. Lowe gave this morning? And that he deferred that we pass a question on to you regarding a critical source area?
Yes.
So I just want to pick up on that question briefly. So, do you have his speaking notes with you? This is that paragraph 21. So I just want to touch on that paragraph B and that threshold question. So my question to you is, do you agree with the proposition that there's two ways to deal with that threshold? One, you could incorporate it in the definition, or the other way is that you could keep the definition simple and deal with that threshold through the plan provisions?
Can I just, sorry, so you have a point of clarification to what threshold you're referring
to? So an area of landform infrastructure that, and then there's paragraph A, and then the next paragraph is paragraph B. I'll just read that out. So that says it's the potential to result in the loss of a large quantity of contaminants to downstream surface water bodies when compared to adjacent land use. And that's slightly different to the version that the Director General is referring to, which is a much simplified B, which is simply states there's a contaminant pathway to downstream surface water bodies. So when I say the threshold, it's the large quantity threshold.
Okay,
sorry,
can you repeat the question?
Sure. Yeah, so my question is that threshold and that B, you could deal with that in two ways. One is incorporate it in the definition critical source area, or you could deal with the threshold around the quantity in the plan provisions themselves. Got another way to phrase it, I think.
Yes, I think you could. So if you're referring to the threshold being large, so what that actually means, from a planning perspective, it means I think you could do either. But I suppose the risk of defining what the threshold is, unless you have that empirical evidence to back it up, then it's probably one of the subsection that you test, depending on what it is and what it means. I wonder whether or not I'm not a pharmacist expert at all, so I'm very careful what I say here, but I wonder whether or not some level of on-farm interpretation is the best way of dealing with it, in terms of whether the pharmacist's plan of beliefs it is large versus, say, not large.
And on that basis, would be better to keep the definition simple so it stands the test of time better?
Quite possibly.
Thank you. I've got no further questions.
Mel? Signal to you, I have a very small handful of topics that I'd like to talk to you about. First being your proposed definition of not practicable in your latest Schedule C, and that's your amended Schedule C, which is now shown in blue text on the undated version of the document. And really, to cut to the chase, what I want to talk to you about is whether that definition is complete, because as you have drafted it now, it is a definition that attempts to capture all instances where a setback distance will be varied because it's not practicable. Can you just confirm that was your intention?
Yes, it was my intention to try and codify what not practical would mean based on what I heard from farms and
said you're not a farm systems expert, but you were raised on a sheep beef farm, which right, isn't it?
I was.
So you do have some familiarity with farming, those farming systems. Well, these are general questions. So if we work through some instances in perhaps in addition to what you have here, you talk about, and when I say here, I mean your definition, not practicable, just to be precise. So we in B, you talk about the fence needing to connect to an existing permanent fence or any other existing constructive barrier formed by topography or vegetation. Is that intended to include, say, a great big mature oak tree in the middle of the paddock, or is that something else?
No, I don't believe so.
A practicability concern might be large vegetation that you have to go around.
Yes, I was actually thinking like the basic artery hedges in the line, which do exist in some parts of the world, but still. If there was one of those that was within, say, probably more than a metre from the edge of the bed, there was a way to fix a fence or to plant additional vegetation that may well create that barrier. That might be a reason why you would have an exception.
Okay. You talk about, in your A, you talk about terrain forming a physical impediment. Would terrain include something like a very large rock?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So your view is within the normal understanding of the word terrain, it's going to capture a large rock or something like that. Or do you think possibly we could mention rock or something similar as well, it would be clearer?
I can see that without going into definitions and definitions, but some more substance around what terrain means might be useful. I did have the word topography here for a little bit, but I thought that might be a little bit too vague.
Right.
But for me, terrain also stays what's there in existing as well. So if you were to find a line of fence up, and there was a bunch of rocks around it, but in the alignment that you were trying to choose, then perhaps you might choose to go somewhere else, unless you want a lot of work.
Yeah, sure. And topography is not likely to catch a rock in its normal, in terms of the normal meaning of the word topography, a rock's not really included in that.
Not really. Rock forms, formations are.
Rock, yeah, okay.
But that doesn't include big rocks that might fall on a cliff somewhere else. Okay. So that's the point.
Yeah, okay. And would you accept from me that in some circumstances it might be unsafe to get, say, a post hole driver or something like that to where you need to fence, particularly on a steep land?
Absolutely. You need to construct the fence that requires post hole drivers.
And so with safety considerations perhaps arising out of legislation, could that make the siting of a fence impracticable?
I would say it could if the type of fence you were trying to construct meant you had to have that particular piece of equipment and there was no other alternative.
Okay. And you, I expect you might have heard my questions of Mr. Lowe earlier, and I asked him about farm infrastructure, and you've picked up in your C an existing man-made farm track, and that might have been after a discussion we had recently. Would you agree with me that other infrastructure like sheds and troughs, which were the two examples I used with Mr. Lowe, may well impact on the size of the setback and alignment of the fence as well?
Yes, I think it's easy they could if they were located within the 3 metres from the stream.
Okay. So, I could go on, but perhaps just in the interest of moving things along, I mean, would you be prepared to accept from me that perhaps trying to define impracticable with the examples I've given you is a difficult task and perhaps an inclusive definition, if there is a mischief the court determines is appropriate, we need to solve with this phrase impracticable, could be a way to address the concerns about the breadth of impracticability that might arise?
Yes, I would agree. The only thing that is in the back of my mind is the ability for someone to
appropriately use an exception to curate the outcome that wasn't anticipated by the sovereign regulations. And I just feared the optics of one poorly performing practitioner against people who have done the right thing. That's the only concern I had with the trying to define it. But I can take the point.
So that's the mischief, to use my phrase, that you're worried about, right? Okay, all right. Thank you. Can I just ask you now about your proposed rule 3.11.4.4, 4B, subclause 2, sub something else, small b. Now that's for the record only. Read through that, but for everyone else, you'll find it on the second page of the undated version of provisions starting with policy 5 that was circulated a short while ago.
Four capital B,
yeah. Number 2,
yeah.
Small b. And it's the clause with the little bit of blue writing at the start. So, let's call it the joint pastoral farming party, so that's my client, Federated Farmers and Fonterra, proposed a version of Schedule C, which might I say is somewhat improved on when it comes to structure, a couple of weeks ago. Are you familiar with that version that was handed up the week of the second week of the hearing?
I am familiar with it, right.
And one of the provisions proposed for the record, it was at clause 5C, allowed a farm planner to certify in writing that the fencing of an intermittently flowing river is not practicable, provided the measures proposed in the FEP will achieve the outcomes of policy 2B small f. You recall that?
Yes, I don't know.
That's fine, we don't have to do it. Okay, and you have proposed with the impracticality provisions that you have proposed, you haven't picked up that exception for intermittent rivers in the same way that my client and others have?
Not in the same way, no.
Right. The way you've dealt with it instead is from that rule that I've highlighted, that for intermittently flowing streams, you say a tailored solution may be approved as part of a farm environment plan log with a resource consent application, and that's a controlled activity pathway.
That would be provided that you run through your seat.
Yes.
And we're talking about land above 10 degrees slope.
Yes.
And we're talking about intermittent flowing rivers that are wider than 1 metre.
Yes.
In this particular case. So, yes.
Thank you.
Down to that, yes.
Yes. Okay, that's helpful. And so you might recall Mr. Berry's evidence amongst others. And Mr. Berry's evidence was that hill country farms have numerous seeps and small waterfalls that flow at different times of the year. Do you recall that evidence? And his evidence also was that it's not practicable to get tractors to a lot of those sites, particularly as it gets steeper. And that it was also not practicable to drive fence posts by hand or to dig the holes for the fence posts by hand. Do you recall that evidence? And it might have been Mr. Pennell, actually, who said that he doesn't think fencing contractors would be prepared to do that anyway. Do you recall that evidence?
I don't recall that, no.
Okay.
I said that.
Thank you. And then also there are issues of practicability about getting power to some of those higher, steeper sites for temporary fences. You recall that evidence as well?
I do.
Okay. And so, based on the provision that you've proposed, for a dry stock farm who can otherwise comply with Schedule C and prepare a farm plan in accordance with the standards under D1, that farmer, who would otherwise be a permitted activity and is a low-risk farmer, would require a resource consent, controlled activity consent, wouldn't they?
Yes, if they couldn't fly with Gentle Seaman 5 years or three.
Right. And so, did you hear the evidence at the start of the hearing? It might have been my friend Mr. Matheson was cross-examining Mr. Trevilco about the nature of a resource consent, council planner who was processing such a consent. Do you recall that evidence?
I do.
And do you agree with Mr. Trevilco that it's likely that that person would be guided by the certified farm planner as to the alternative solution?
Yes, I do.
Do you see it as an efficient outcome or a more effective outcome to go through that process rather than dealing with it at the front end through a certified farm plan?
I would, and because I say that I would, is that if the farmer works 90% of the way through their compliance with Schedule C and within the 5 year time frame, and they have intention to do that, then yes, the last 10% of the productivity seems a little bit harsh, and that we could do that in another way. But my concern would be for the recalcitrant owner who did nothing and was, had no intention to do anything, then it would be more appropriate to pick that up through the national resource consent. And in my, I won't repeat the rule numberings, but in my, the outcome I envisage for that particular amendment would be a stop assuming fencing plan that was staged and had time frames associated with it that could then be in conditions of control of that resource consent.
Dealing with that recalcitrant farmer, wouldn't that be more of an enforcement issue? I mean, so that band is probably going to be breaching a number of rules. Wouldn't that be more efficient to deal with it that way?
I think the first thing you'll see will be when they're fired in a recovery resource consent. And perhaps if the certification process of the first home buying plan agreed they were going to do a certain thing by a certain time, the action plans potentially, and then that was reviewed, then you might pick up something that's a low audit grade. But then if they contested the audit grade on the farming rents, if they went back to the direction and came back, then you might not see them for 3 or 4 years. So my understanding is that the SWRC are thinking about increasing their compliance effort exponentially, then I have some doubts that you can catch the recalcitrant farmer early anyway. But my point, I think the point you raised is right. I'll go back to the initial point. If someone's close to it, then yes, it's going to be easier to go through the certification process than the consent process. But there are, it's a binary thing with resource consent, if you are or not, and unfortunately it does capture people who probably could have had that taken care of in terms of voluntary compliance. Just difficult. I can't find a way to rationalise it properly for you to give you the answer that you want. Safe to say that I think it's better off to cover the risks of someone not doing something, and given that the soccer student is a fundamental part of plan change one, I think it would warrant at least a control activity.
Thank you, Ron.
Firstly, Mr. Brough, I'd like to specifically acknowledge and thank you for the edit that you've made in 5A on page 2, which you didn't speak to before, but thank you very much for that change. My other question is just a clarification for the record. Your document on its face appears to be a complete replacement of Schedule C from the consolidated version, but I did just want to check with you that clauses 6 to 9 Schedule C, as found in the consolidated version, still apply. Is that correct?
That is correct. And
thank you, sir. So for the record, on page Schedule C in the consolidated post-conference version starts on page 40 in terms of 51, clauses 6 onwards on page 41, would be even under this proposal.
That is correct. We need to reinsert those. If you chose that this was a useful structure to go forward with, and there's also a wider exclusion for CDP as well that sits there, that would probably need to be wound back in.
Clause 6 to 9 of the post-conference conversion remains with Mr. Brough's Schedule C. So
as I understand it, sir, both the joint farming parties, or whatever they're called, and then, sorry, not into that. And then this latest version as simply replacing clauses 1 to 5 and the associated exclusions from GPC, but that from the heading fertilizer application onwards would remain in both, well, in all versions of Schedule C.
Right. So, to follow on from 6 to 9 in this
picture.
Yes. Correct. That is correct, sir. And just to completeness, that exclusion down the very bottom, which the reads clause 9 does not apply to individual production, I did not include that in my version of Schedule C instruction.
Because, of course, the Te Tiri Whai Mana prevails over an inconsistent provision in a national policy statement. You don't see that Te Tiri Whai Mana would prevail over Policy 11 of the NPCFM, would you? And that talks about existing over-allocation is phased out and future over-allocation is avoided.
I would say to it quite simply in terms of the objective direction is to the common. So I would say, with the two orchids are quite well.
Yes, so when we think about all existing over allocation being phased out, that's similar to the restoration objective of Te Tiri Whai Mana, isn't it? Phasing out existing over allocation. And so, and PC1 provides a trajectory for that phasing out, which is the 20% improvement over 10 years.
Is it the same objective it does? Is it associated with Table 31?
Yes. So, having said that, I just wanted to clarify with you what you mean by headroom, and you've put this in Policy 18B, a new provision relating to recognising reductions that have cumulatively been achieved for use of title penalty lands. By headroom, do you mean additional capacity, and I know it's difficult from an accounting perspective, but any additional capacity beyond that beyond reaching the 20% tracking required in 10 years? Do you understand what I mean there? If, say, you're tracking 30% over 10 years, that would give you headroom. What if you're tracking 20%? Would you still say there's headroom there?
I think if you had an accounting framework that was capable, but was sufficient enough to inform the consideration of the resource consent that there are a number of mitigation measures put in place for pointless discharges, confused discharges, the farm environment plans, and they were going to have effect in time, then you probably could be confident that the cumulative implementation of Chapter 3 or 11 would provide you with to enable the future development of the ancestral land. But I acknowledge that may be a long road for when you do not have an accounting framework, or in fact, anything that is even an accounting framework to even record the mitigation actions that may or hopefully will be put in place through farm development plans and also through policy discharges and resource consent.
Thank you. Are you happy in Policy 5, which refers to offsetting compensation and provides an opportunity for other land use change potentially beyond tangible lands? you happy even as a non-applying activity? Are you happy to leave that expensive provision for offsetting a compensation which DOC and Fish and Game says doesn't comply with best practice principles available for those other nets?
I think that's a case-by-case assessment would be required for that. The Tangata Whenua Ancestral Land Development, I think the example I gave before, that this still having 1 month period where there's no way on a property-by-property basis that they can generalise the discharge that will result from the new land use. But that may not be the case for other land uses that seem to change.
And that's why you put subject to policy 18 at the top of policy 5.
Yes, that is correct. I think it's worthwhile making that distinction to policy 5 that it's just not even available to come to the central land, in my view.
But you haven't picked up on the belief that Dr. Fish and Game is speaking to nail down policy 5 for other lands.
I have actually, well, who's other lands?
I mean, not non-Tangata Whenua land, yeah.
And you're referring to the changes being advanced
by the SMR as well.
Yes, I have considered that, and changed the laws between A and B to N's, it just makes the situation more untenable for Tangata Whenua land. So I have actually considered that, and I still think that the front end of that policy, being subject to policy 18, is probably the best approach for Tangata Whenua ancestral land.
Okay, so you're focusing on Tangata Whenua ancestral land. You're not really commenting on its use for other land.
No, I'm not.
Right. And just finally, I had a interchange with Dr. O'Say earlier about the low reduction cap would be required for lakes and some uncertainty around that at the moment. And potentially locking those loads, given that lakes are on the first tranches for EPPs. Have you turned your mind to whether there should be a shorter consent term for farming and lake catchments, given that conundrum?
I haven't explicitly turned my mind to it, but I think about the amendments that I propose to policy 7, which talks about consent duration, then I think it's even more appropriate that that wording is picked up, so the consent duration is pretty up to 15 years as opposed to the inference that they start at 15. So to the extent that that's the issue.
Kind of, but thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cronin.
Your rebuttal statement in that you say that you don't think commercial vegetable production should be pitched at the freshwater management unit scale. That's at 31 of your rebuttal. Have you heard anything over the past 4.5 weeks change that view?
I have, and I guess my take on the commercial vegetable production regulatory framework attached to the policy framework is that if you were to consent all existing CVP, so you have a cumulative existing footprint, so you know where it is, and you can pitch that out. I'll get your level and also the need for you. If you were to operate a rotational framing on that existing footprint, then you could potentially rotate out some of the site catcher as long as it was within the existing footprint. So that would differ from my rebuttal in that the collection of site catchments for me for you. So to that extent, yes.
And you're aware that the farm environment plans for commercial vegetable production need to identify the land that they intend to rotate on?
The future land use.
So that would address your concerns?
It would so far if we were talking about the existing footprint for CDP.
So the farm environment plans identify the land that the consent would relate to, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
And that could be at, and that would identify all of the land that the growers were intending to, that the consent would relate to, that they were growing on and intended, anticipated to use.
So in this case, the consent relates to which rules you're referring to, the control activity rules or the discretion activity rules?
Both in relation to the farm environment plan.
Okay, well, I'll speak to the control activity rules firstly. So that's the rule I'm referring to when all commercial visual production comes through that particular gateway, if you want to call it that, or doorway, and the regional council understands the existing footprint of the if you attach that to a farm environment plan for CDP, which then anticipates where the future rotation should be, provided those future rotations are within the existing footprint, then my thinking as a planner, it doesn't really matter whether they are outside the subcatchment that they are initially first located in. So it's more about the effect of the cumulative footprint. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Excellent. Can I speak to the discretion activity rule? Because if you are having a farm environment plan that is signaling future rotation outside of that collective footprint, then that is a new CDP. That has to go through that gateway.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes, so within the controlled activity, when the consent's applied for existing CDP, and that consent, the environment plan in that consent application identifies the land for CDP that can be at a farm FMU scale.
I believe so. I can say, the wider risk is within an existing footprint. If the gateway tests that particular rule, and then the council understands what that looks like, then from an operational point of view, if someone wants to lease another block of land within that same existing footprint, there should be no effect. There should be no corporate risk. And that may well be outside the subcatchment, and that's why change of use is my rebuttal. So I didn't quite understand that nuance, and I was concerned that we were conflating two rules and that we might have what I was rather rotation, sorry, you seem to be being dragged by rotating outside that existing footprint.
Thank you.
Is it possible I'll pay for the all that's in my dotage?
I haven't seen you.
Yeah, the word's possible.
Yes.
If a non-compliant activity is included in PC1, is it possible that every single council section 42A report will recommend a grant against the grant of consent?
Possible.
If PC1 includes an RD or D activity status, is it possible that applications will be declined?
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Any re-examination?
No, not after that, sir.
Call on you more often.
Just a couple of minutes, Mr. Ruff, and welcome back. In relation to Policy 18, your new draft, and in particular the new B, which you include, was only talking to the National Policy Statement 11. Do you recall that?
Okay.
So when I had a quick look at the certificate of it does speak in objectives B, C, and D about restoration and protection of the relationship of Waikato-Tainui with the river, including the economic and social, cultural and spiritual relationships. It does talk about the restoration and protection of the relationship that they have, with, according to their tikanga, with the river, including the economic, social and spiritual relationships, and similarly in there. So I interpret that your attempt here in B is to give effect to that. Or am I wrong?
That's correct.
Right. And as you indicated, it's specific to Tangata Whenua, ancestral land and nothing else.
That's correct.
Right. And just in relation to Mr. Conway's questions of you earlier, you were here, I think, in the first week when questions were being asked of the Waikato Regional Council witnesses about the ability for Tangata to give effect to go through that non-compliant process, and in the number of questions that I put to their witnesses, their indication was, as Mr. Majuri is quickly going through, it's possible, but I get the impression, and I get the impression you wanted to say, not probably.
I think it's a fair assessment.
All right, thank you. That's all right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Brock. Just one point of clarification, really. With Tangata ancestral land, it seems to me that the idea is you want to get to a situation where you're definitely on the pathway down, reducing the nitrogen, before you allow some additional allowance for TWA element. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what one way to do it, recognizing that the accounting system isn't fully in place yet, to say that once you've achieved a 20% reduction, for example, then you could allow a percentage of that reduction to be put aside to TWA land. And just to give you an idea of what that means, at 20% reduction of nitrogen, you'd have reduced it by 500 tonnes a year. If you granted an allocation to the first third of the TWAL, and put in a load of 30 kilograms per hectare for that, which is middle of the range, that would be about 100 tonnes. So it seems as a very practical level, it would provide certainty by saying that once you've achieved 20%, you could allow maybe 10 or 20% as an allocation for TWA land up to the maximum of the 9,000 hectares. Do you have a view on that kind of approach as a practical way to
I am not expressed here on that, but I just find the notion of a basic limit difficult to parallel with a particular ancestral land, and particularly one where we really don't have the empirical information at this time to demonstrate that the proportion of that load could then be attributed or allocated, using a bad allocation word, to a certain land class. It's possible we could do it that way. And the other thing I would say is that when you have 500 iwi across a large catchment, it's impossible to pick a winner when you try and allocate that particular load across the catchment, I think. And I think we run into problems very quickly with that. So, whilst it's possible to do it, I have difficulty in my own mind understanding what that might look like.
At least provide some kind of guidance that an allowance would be made. That's what I was trying to get to. How is this distributed beyond that from a different process, I guess. But no, you've given me your answer, that's fine. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your reference, Mr. Brock. Yes. That's the case for the River Ewing. That's it. Yeah, yes. Right, well, we'll take a brief return now. We'll return at 10 to 4. Mr. Majuri, you'll be ready then, and Mr.